Usually when I do a, there's a reason why you don't have a schedule. It used to be that we would set up schedules and it's 30 minutes sit, 30 minute walk, 30 minutes sit, 30 minute walk. And I found that during the 30 minute walk, it was a break time and people just kind of, you walked maybe, you got tea, it just made it harder for non-residentials to get the kind of concentration and samadhi that really is possible if you give yourself a day to practice. It really is. We can get very still even with one day. It doesn't take a heavy lift. And so when I started doing retreats online, I learned how we could create a way to have more space, more stillness, more actual practice time. And so that's what we're going to do together today. The way we'll do it is we're going to do, what I begin to realize is that on a non-residential, when you just have a day or two to really devote to practice, the longer meditation periods don't always work because your mind is not as settled. It takes a little while for the mind that is working all week to settle. And so what works better, I think, are short meditations, short walking. So 20-minute meditation, 20-minute walking, 20-minute meditation, 20-minute walking. And we'll do this all tied together. So instead of thinking of this as a 20-minute walk or a 20-minute sit, what we're going to have is an hour and a half of practice. And that hour and a half of practice kind of comes together. And stillness for an hour and a half, it's very palpable. It's very noticeable. And so we'll do that in the morning and we'll do it in the afternoon. So to that end, I don't need a bell ringer. Like we usually have a bell ringer. What I'm hoping is that for the people here in the room, that we find a way to walk either right here in this room or right outside the doors, and I'll ring the bell between there. If it looks like there's not enough space for us to really walk like that, then we can use upstairs, and I'll still ring the bell upstairs. But for those of you that are at home, it's a different process because you're not in a space where you're feeling as connected as we are here. So the way that you can keep the same level of stillness is to find something at home that you can do, like clean the bathroom, rearrange the closet like you've been wanting to forever, stack those papers up, getting everything all organized. Find some simple task to organize something, fix something, clean something. It could even be like laundry, and you're just putting the clothes in the laundry and folding it. Something to keep the mind having to do something, and yet you are not going to dwell off into other things. We're going to have the thinking mind pointed towards a particular question. And so this act, because you're at home, you can do the walking if that supports you. That's what I'd like you to do. But if you can't, it's better to just do activity at home. It doesn't change. We call it walking, but really it's movement. That's all it is. So it doesn't matter if your movement is folding clothes, cleaning the toilets. It doesn't matter. There's no difference between the two. It's what your mind is doing that you're mostly interested in. And if you keep your mind steady during your closed folding time, then when you come back in for sitting, it's the same process. What I really am encouraging us is during the practice period not to let go of the fact that you're practicing. That's the only thing you're really holding on to, is the whole period you're still practicing. So what that means is, at the end of the sit, there will be one small light bell just to signify that we're in a transition, but we won't actually have three bells until the end of the whole period. And then that shows that we're finished with the whole period. So the end of the sit, small bell. End of the walking, small bell. And it's just like they are reminder bells to keep us steady on the process. And you can get very settled this way. And so that's what we're going to try. And then I thought I'd check to see how many of you were not at the talk last night. So we'll see how much kind of a review I have to do. Okay? What about online? How many of you? Oh, what about over here? Anybody who wasn't at the talk? Okay. What about online? How many do we have there? Okay. It's quite a few, so. All right, so I can't go over the whole talk, and so that's just something you can listen to at a later time, but I'll give you a gist of where we're pointed, and I'm going to then frame how we're going to practice today, and then the way we'll sort of be is I'll do a talk, then we'll start our practice period, and then we'll have some question, answers, comments, whatever. And then we'll do the same thing in the afternoon. I'll give a framing, then we'll have the practice period, and then we'll have some questions and comments and whatever comes up. So we are talking about right intention. And I was saying last night that I like the idea of calling this right intention instead of wise intention, because this framing of wise in the English language means that it's kind of a skillful thing to do. But that's not what I think this intention, right intention, is as a path factor. Right intention is telling you this is the right way to go if you're going to be awakened. So you can go another way. It's not right or wrong, like right intention or there's wrong intention. It's not a right or wrong. I don't think the Buddha ever spoke in this kind of right or wrong. It's more that if you want to awaken the mind, this is the right way to go. And this is the only way to go in order to get to right intention. So if you if you're cultivating right intention, what we are going to sort of practice with today is figuring out, how do I discern what is right intention versus intention that's not going to lead to awakening? We have intention, this word intention. I'll back up a little bit here and give a little bit more of a framing. This intention is called a path factor because it's part of the Eightfold Path. It's the second part of the Eightfold Path. The path itself is divided up into three trainings. You train in wisdom, you train in ethical conduct, and you train in samadhi, stilling the mind, concentration. So you train in wisdom, two aspects, right view, right intention. So that's the way you're looking at the world, the way you're looking at experience, looking at the moment, and the intention behind it is where wisdom lies. The second part, this ethical conduct, is basically our precepts. When we say the precepts, those five precepts we say at retreats, so that would be right conduct, that would be right speech, so extra energy around watching what you say, and right livelihood. That's our conduct. And then in the samadhi training, there's right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And it's strange because in the West, we have always put an emphasis on samadhi, that training. We all go to retreats, we're always trying to get still, we're heavily focused on meditation, and that's it. That's where we think the meat is, and then everything else is going to follow once I get still. If I can get my mind still, now I'm going to be okay. But the Buddha, I don't think it's a mistake that wisdom is first, because you cultivate sort of where you're going. And you got a compass of the intention, and then you're going to go. So the example I used last night was, if I leave my house to head towards Canada, I have to turn left because that's north. I can turn right and I can start heading right, but I will never get to Canada. Or if I do, it's going to take a long time. But at some point, I'm going to have to start turning north. I'm going to have to start turning left. But if I turn left and I'm pointed in the right direction, whether I'm on I-5 and I take the freeway straight up, or whether I take all the side roads and I walk, or I'm in a car, or I'm in a tractor, it doesn't matter. It may take a while to get there, but I will eventually, without a doubt, come to the Canadian border. And this is what I think the Buddha was saying, that if you point your view and your intention towards awakening in the right direction, you will eventually awaken the mind. There is no heavy lift. There's no extra work you have to do. There's no special life you have to have in order for you to be awakened where everybody else can be awakened. It's not like that. It's just pointing your attention, your compass in the right direction. And then when you do that, you will eventually, at some point, come to the Canadian border. You will come to awakening. We, in the Western way of looking at things, we tend to think that me to A, I have to make myself awakened. You have to make yourself awaken. You got to do your job. Do what you're supposed to do and get it done. And you're judging yourself. So many people come to me all the time and they're like, my practice is gone. I can't even meditate. I just don't have it. And I'm like, you're just taking the side road. That's it. You just got off the freeway, took an exit. Now you're on the side road. Maybe there's a tractor in front of you. You kind of slowed down a bit. You're walking. But you haven't left the path because you're still headed north and you're still in the right direction. So what the Buddha, I think, cultivated is this understanding that if you cultivate your wisdom, your actions will follow. And when your actions begin to come in alignment with right, the precepts, basically, then your samadhi will come automatically. It is not something you have to make. I think we struggle with samadhi because our conduct is not the way we want it to be, and we're not actually focused in the right direction. So we're going south, grumbling about the fact we can't get to the Canadian border. We've been walking for 10 days. I can't get to the border. And it's because we're not going in the right direction. So even at the end of our, when we're at our wit's end, we turn and focus towards the north, we will eventually get there. Doesn't matter when you turn north. And so that's what I want to cultivate this weekend, is how to begin to turn towards north and understand where north is. And how do I do that? The second thing that I think we're not looking at the view today. We're just going to look at intention itself. And the second part of the Buddha's way of teaching this as a path factor, he doesn't teach like we do, to me. So over the years of my both being a practitioner and as a teacher, There's a way in which we want to know exactly how to do the Dhamma, and then I'll do that. You tell me what to do, and then I'll do that. And we all kind of have that sense of, once I know what I'm supposed to do, then I'll do it, or I should know what I'm supposed to do because I'm a practitioner, so I should know. How come I keep messing up? There's that way that we hold practice that I think is not in alignment with the way the Buddha taught Dhamma. The way that he taught it is by discernment. So it isn't so much what you do as much as it is beginning to weigh what happens if I do this, what happens if I do that. So the cultivation of what is right intention doesn't come so much from me telling you what right intention is, as much as it comes towards me encouraging you to find what right intention is. And we begin to find out what right intention is, not by knowing it ahead of time, but by having found our way. And when we find our way, it doesn't really matter what someone else tells you. You will not forget. You will not question it. You will question it if I tell you something and say, this is right intention. This is the way you should be. Or as the Mandalorian says, this is the way. Oh, good. I was hoping you guys would know what the Mandalorian was. This is the way. I can say that. But you will not believe it. Because as soon as your mind has an opportunity to challenge that, it will. So this is not for any one person, teacher or not, to tell you how to find right intention. This is encouraging you to look for right intention, to come to know it for yourself, and then you will never stray away from it. You will always be with it. So the second thing I wanted to carry over from last night's talk is this idea of what this word intention is. Because intention itself, the way we're going to sort of talk about it primarily is thought. But intention is connected to what we say, what we do, and what we think. So it's thoughts, it's both mental, it's physical, and it's energetic. And I think the reason why is because right thought, right intention is also considered right thought, and it's considered karma, your karma, whatever. That comma, we tend to hold that word like it's you getting your comeuppance, you getting your just desserts, you getting what you get, what you deserve. But actually, comma is the word for action, just the doing of something. And right intention is tied to action. Whatever your intention is, whether you know that intention exists or not, is going to lead to a particular result. And you can back up and understand your intentions by noticing the actual action you're doing. So you may not, we have a way of saying, if I didn't think what I did was going to harm somebody, we say, I didn't intend to harm you because I didn't think it would harm you for me to do this. But in right intention, it's this knowing that if I intended to do the action, I am responsible for the result. It's not that the intention and the result are tied together as one. So it is a continuous loop. So if I intend to do an action and I didn't intend harm, but I find out later that harm actually came, then that is a kind of a mechanism for us to learn whether or not this is the best or skillful way to do an act. Do you see what I'm saying? You actually are learning it from the end result and then looking back, rather than what we tend to do is, because we didn't intend harm, harm happens. We push that harm away because that we don't want to feel or that we don't want to see, and we never learn the intention that actually caused that result. So if, on the other hand, we begin to look at intention from this side, no matter what happens out there, we use our actions to look at our intentions. Now we're beginning to see things that are otherwise hidden because you don't see that initial intention. You can see it clearly just by looking at your actions. And your actions are very clear, and it's very obvious. And I hope that by the end of the weekend, you will not, if I back up a bit, the reason why we don't look at our end result is because oftentimes the end result of our behavior can be disruptive. It can be a little difficult. And we live in a culture that constantly shames us for everything we do. And we do it in the States, we do it here, we do it all over the West. It's like this constant, like a spotlight on us, constantly judging everything we see that we do. So we have a tendency to close our eyes to what we do if we didn't intend any harm. And this idea of looking back, it's almost like it's held in a framing of judging ourselves for what we did because of something that happens. I hope by the end of this weekend, you will not have that thinking. We can do something to readjust that, because the Buddha did not teach like that. And in many of our actions, we will not know the intention unless we're ready and able to look at physically what we're doing and then back up into what the intention was. So intention connected to thought, it's also connected to physical actions, that's a comma, and it's connected to impulse. So how it's connected to impulse is that you see the physical conduct, you back it up and you begin to notice the thinking process, and then you can back it up even further where you can notice the impulse to do something, that impulse. But we won't notice that impulse first. It comes in reverse. And we try, how many times do we try to tell ourselves, we hear something, we see something, you say, that's the way I want to be. Okay, that's what I'm going to do in my life. And we keep doing the opposite of that. And we keep trying our best to catch ourselves so we don't do a habit, or we stop doing this, or we start doing that. I can remember setting this intention that I was going to sit every day. Every day, I just loved it. I would go and I would sit and I liked it, so I'm like, I'm going to sit every day. Did not happen. I would put my bench in the hallway so I can't miss it. Sure enough, I would go to bed. I'd be like, dang it, I was going to sit today. We don't see the impulse that pushes us towards life and pushes us and moves us. And that impulse is the fundamental thing we're trying to get to. But it's so subtle and it's so unconscious that to look for it, to try to find a way to, you know, I'm going to fix this, I'm going to do this, that, yeah, we're setting ourselves up for failure. So instead, I want to share a way that the Buddha taught his own son how to look for this. and use that as an example of how to find our way into this impulse, to begin to know what the impulse is. It's very doable. It's very accessible. So this weekend is really about practicing with right intention, practicing with the what does it take, how does it come about that I can learn to build on what I learned this weekend to begin to cultivate this right intention in my life, just period, all the time, and not be stuck with this constant judgment that I'll never get this right or it's never going to be the way I want it to be. Let's see. Oh, there's one other piece that we're... So the way I thought about doing this is we're going to divide it up into three sections. The first section is going to be this morning. Second section is going to be this afternoon. Third section is tomorrow morning. So the first section, we're going to begin to just begin to see what kind of mind we're working with. We got to see what kind of mind we're working with. And it took a long time for me to understand this. It's probably going to be a strange thing to say, but it took a long time for me to really be appreciative that I had such a messed up life. It took a long time, because usually a messed up life means that, you know, I had so many problems, my mind was, it was just based in trauma, and there was always complaining, and I'm a Virgo, so nothing's ever right, and I just, it was like this kind of, that kind of mind in and of itself sounds like you can never meditate. That's just impossible. Because every time I would sit, I would just constantly sit there complaining about everything. And because I thought that the right kind of mind doesn't have that happening. It's very peaceful, very calm. Yeah, no. That calm mind is so deluded that it is not a good mind to work with, because you don't have anything to see the problem. It's too calm. Why would anybody want to disrupt a calm mind? But if you already have a disrupted mind, it's much easier to calm that mind down. So, I don't know how many of you have the disrupted mind, but that is a better mind to work with. I have come to understand that. So this, we're going to look at the nature of mind. And I don't want you to judge that mind at all this morning. So the morning practice is really about having a level of appreciation for the mind as it is, noticing the mind itself. This is the mind you're working with. And a disruptive mind is not a problem. It is knowing skillfully what to do with a disruptive mind. But the fact that the mind is disruptive, that is the nature of being human. In fact, if you think about it, a disruptive mind is the mind you need in order to awaken. Because it's like the human realm is in between the hungry ghost realm, which is just this constant craving and never being satisfied, and the heavenly realms, where it's very peaceful and blissful. But you're so peaceful, you're not going to try to get to change anything. It's why teachers kind of poo-poo jhana states. For people that are really, really trying to get to jhana, and you'll go to a teacher and you'll be like, I really want to, how can I get to that first jhana? And teachers will be like, why you gonna bother? You know, it's no big deal, don't go there. And you're like, something happened. I had this magnificent experience. And they're like, all right, well, let's move on. It's because there's this in this way we're trying to persuade you not to be captivated by those blissful states. Because those blissful states are beautiful and they are very captivating. But once you get there, you really don't want to do anything else. You don't want to do anything to disrupt that blissful state. And it becomes that the whole practice is how do I get to the next blissful state? And you ignore all the wisdom that's going to lead to awakening because you start heading south towards the sun. It's like I'm going to Mexico. It's too cold in Canada. Why would we want to go there? They got snow and rain and stuff. Let's go to Mexico. It's all warm and sunny. So that's what we end up doing, and we miss the possibility for awakening. But if you have a mind that is disruptive and periods of stillness and disruptive, and periods of stillness, now it's going to keep you interested in how do I get to that stillness and why do I keep getting disrupted? What's taking me away? What leads there? And that looking at what is the nature that brings us into stillness and what is the nature that takes us out of that stillness, when you start looking for that, now you're getting more and more and more skillful. Wiser and wiser, and you're off the dirt road and you're getting on the freeway. So that process is what we're going to look at this morning, just noticing the nature of the mind. And then this afternoon, we are going to look at the Buddha divided his thoughts up. So first we're going to just look at our mind's thinking. Then this afternoon, we're going to look at the thoughts. The Buddha divided up his thoughts into what was could be considered skillful and what was unskillful, what he called wholesome and what was not wholesome. He didn't judge it one way or the other. This is unwholesome, this is wholesome. And when it's unwholesome, this is what happens. And when it's wholesome, this is what happens. And so we're just going to divide the thoughts up and begin to notice what kind of thoughts we have. And then tomorrow, we're going to apply this more rigorous, skillful way of dealing with the thoughts and dealing with what we're doing and consider a way to actually discern right intention itself. We'll save that for tomorrow morning. So that's the plan. And we're going to do it in little bits. Only have one rule. And this is the only rule we have to apply. When we're sitting, this for you even at home, when we're sitting, the one rule is that no matter what thoughts come up and the mind will try to sneak some thoughts in, we are once we notice we're thinking, we're letting them go and we're coming back to an anchor. So we're going to find the anchor at this first sit. Anchor, and then when we're sitting, the idea is no matter how many times you have to do it, it doesn't really matter. There's no judgment anyway. You're just going to constantly come back to the anchor. And when we're walking and moving, now you can let the mind think and have thoughts, and we're going to just see what kind of thoughts they are. When you come back and you're sitting, anytime thoughts come up, we're going to let those go, and we're going to come back to the anchor. Anchor, anchor, anchor. So that's the only rule that we have, is that it's short sit, it's only 20 minutes, not this thing where you have to sit here for 40 minutes trying to keep your mind still. This is 20 minutes, come back to the anchor, noticing the anchor, and then when we walk is when we'll open up the mind for thinking and contemplation and stuff like that. So that's the only rule. Sound like we can do that. All right, good.